Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a good weekend and that you've got some things done or spent some time with your family or perhaps working on getting to that point. Well, wherever you are, it's good to have you with us. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and today we are going to return to a topic that we've talked a lot about in the past, but it's the first time now that we have the guest that we have with us, and he is perhaps the most scientific, if you will, on the subject, and he's educated in surrounding fields in order to understand this very difficult and convoluted topic. But I think it's an important one. There are many different levels to psychological trauma, trauma-based disorders such as disassociation and other psychological inflictions, such as mind control. From very subtle methods to more overt hands-on techniques, these are areas that have been investigated by intelligence services and military for years, aided by different synthetic drugs, various technologies, and tools in order to break open the mysteries of how to control the mind. Well, media, I would argue, is a kind of mind control. Not only the news and the lies that they spew, but also the cultural Marxists in Hollywood and the entertainment industry, as these are tools to make us hate ourselves and our culture. Well, you know, contradictions is a kind of disassociation. You see one thing in the world, experiencing it a certain way, and then you're told another, a complete opposite in the media. And that happens all the time. It is a kind of disassociation, a schism that is created in your mind, an inner division, and this is the essence of being of two minds, a kind of an early stage of disassociation. Well, but the question is it true that some of the elites in politics, media, entertainment, and the military have in some way been subjected to these techniques? If so, it's a very worrying factor, and the question is if this could explain why then the political and cultural elite have turned on us in the way that they have. Well, we won't be addressing that particular question directly today, but it's something you can have in the back of your mind as we speak about the techniques of psychological trauma and the reality of how disassociation can be used. Well, first, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest here before we get started. Dr. Colin Ross is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of disassociation and trauma-related disorders. He is the founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma. He obtained his MD from the University of Alberta in 81 and completed his training in psychiatry at the University of Manitoba in 1985. He's been running a hospital-based trauma program in Dallas, Texas, since 1991. He does have a couple of books out as well, a couple of these, The Trauma Model, A Solution to the Problem of Comorbidity in Psychiatry. That was first published in 2000 with a second edition in 2007. Other recent books of his include Trauma Model Therapy, The CIA Doctor's Human Rights Violation by American Psychiatrists, and also Moon Shadows, Stories of Trauma and Recovery. In addition, Dr. Ross has authored over 170 professional papers, has reviewed numerous professional journals and grant agencies, and is a past president of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Disassociation. Welcome, Colin. Great to have you here today. Thank you so much for taking some time off speaking with us here.
Well, thanks very much for the invitation.
You bet. So we've actually done a lot of programs over the years on some of the topics that we'll be discussing today. But I think you've done this in a more, scientific, clinical way, if you will, in terms of some of the other people, some of them, most others that we've been speaking about. And obviously, we want to hear more about this today, trying to understand your work and what really is going on out there and how this is being used in the wider context. But, you started the Colin Ross Institute a while back now, many years ago, I think. Just briefly tell us how and why you came to start working in this area, Colin.
Well, I was born in Canada, grew up in Canada. I went to medical school 1977 to 1981 in Canada, then did my psychiatry training from 1981 to 1985. And then I was an academic psychiatrist in Winnipeg in Canada from 1985 to 1991. And then late in 1991, I moved to Texas to work at a trauma program at a hospital in Dallas, where I've been ever since. And within a couple of months arriving in Texas, I started hearing stories from patients with multiple personalities, which is what we specialized in, about not just being abused by mom or dad or uncle or brother, but being taken to military bases, being taken to hospitals, having all kinds of different experiments done on them, and for the purpose basically of creating and controlling new alter personalities. And so I'd never heard of anything like this before. I wasn't particularly interested in it. Wasn't really an official conspiracy theory type person at all. And shortly after the first few stories, a woman handed me some documents, which were MKUltra documents. And again, I hadn't heard of MKUltra, and I kind of looked at this and thought, now this is really strange. And so rather than either believing or not believing, I just decided to look into it. And that was now getting into 92. And so I ended up going down to a CIA reading room in Washington and looking through, which was a very weird experience just by itself, and looking through all the MKUltra documents and then eventually ordering them all. And then when I had them, which is 15,000 pages, all of which had been declassified in the 70s, I went through them in great detail. And then I went to the medical school library over and over and over and over, getting papers from journals from mostly the 1950s, 1960s, a little bit into the 1970s. And that's how I built up this huge pile of documentation of CIA military mind control.
Very good. Now, let's just talk a little bit more about that then. And maybe you can give us a rundown. As I said, we have spoken about this before on past shows, but we might have new listeners with us as well that might be new in this area. So I think it's good to go over some of the basics, if you will, and maybe you can give us kind of an overview on what some of the programs were all about, these military programs.
Sure. Now, everything I'm going to say is based entirely on documentation. And if I tell you anything that isn't, I'll point it out at the time. So, in the Second World War, of course, there's all kinds of intelligence operations going on. And the after a little while after Pearl Harbor, the American government created the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor of the CIA. And they were the central intelligence coordinating entity for the United States. And then the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, was shut down at the end of the war. But basically, all the main people became the CIA when it was founded in September of 1947. And the first CIA mind control program that's documented was created 3 months before the beginning of the Korean War in April 1950. And that's an important date because for a long time up in the 70s at the Senate hearings and so on, CIA personnel claimed that we only set up these programs on a defensive basis in reaction to what the communist Chinese were doing by brainwashing American pilots who'd been down during the Korean War and getting them to make false confessions of germ warfare. So that cannot be factually true because Roscoe Hillenkoetter, who was the director of the CIA, signed Operation Bluebird into existence in April 1950, and the Korean War didn't start until June. So this clearly was not just a reaction to the communist Chinese. So Bluebird started in 1950. It was rolled over into Artichoke, which was then rolled over into MKUltra, which ran up until 1963-4. And then MKUltra was rolled over into MK Search, which ran until 1972 or so. And in parallel to that, there was a series of other programs, MK Naomi, MK Delta, Project Offen, QK Hilltop. And on most of those projects, there's only a very small amount of documentation available. So there's a whole series of overlapping projects, each one running into the other. And then after 1972, basically everything is classified.
So that's only what we have at this point. It's we basically hardly know anything about what's been done after this point. Is that correct?
A few little hints and bits of pieces here and there. So, up until 1984, there was a project called Stargate, and there was also some related projects, which were psychic spying projects. And these were declassified in the 90s. And so that's not in dispute that the CIA spent at least $20 million on various kinds of remote viewing, telepathic spying, etc. And those things, so that takes us up till 1984 or so. And there's some scattered bits of information that I have about other projects going on into the early 90s. And then the little hints we see of ongoing present day organized, structured mind control programs is really the photographs and information coming out of Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib.
Right. Yeah. Okay, we can talk more about later, of course, where we are today and how advanced this has become. It's an awful lot of time here, of course, where we haven't gotten a lot of information about what really is going on, and I doubt they've dropped these kinds of programs. But do you know what this knowledge was based on them? And we do have, hypnosis at a certain stage, Mesmer and some of these people, they did studies of the mind, they did certain things. Is that what the knowledge base was built on? Because obviously it can't just come out of nowhere, this field, correct?
Correct. It's got a number of different sort of overlapping foundations. There's knowledge of brain biology and physiology, neurosurgery, etc. There's electrical engineering aspect to it, psychology, psychiatry, hypnosis, psychiatric and other medications, and then interrogation, torture, brainwashing in the sense of having the person in a cell where you've got total control over them and you can intimidate them, sleep deprivation, food deprivation, isolation, all these techniques that are part of the interrogation brainwashing world. So it's a whole set of different overlapping foundations.
Do we know more about why they wanted to go into this area, and was it, do you think, as a way to try to advance warfare in different departments, or was it a response to something? How much is available documentation-wise on that?
Documentation-wise, it's both, which is always true just in warfare, weapon systems in general. It's always offensive, defensive, and the other side develops this, and then you got to develop a countermeasure to that. And so there's an interesting document in the Bluebird Artichoke documents. So the book, The Manchurian Candidate, and then the movie came out in the late 1950s, and the basic theme of the Manchurian Candidate book is that there's a group of American soldiers who are going through a zone in Manchuria during the Korean War. They're captured, they're interrogated, they're brainwashed, and one of them becomes a programmed assassin who's actually controlled by his mother in the United States. And the goal is for him to shoot a guy who's basically running for vice president of the United States or president. And he gets foiled at the last minute by Frank Sinatra, who is one of the group that was captured and hypnotized. So that's the theme of the book. So several years before the book came out, there's a memo, an internal memo from one CIA officer to another, expressing concern that a group of GIs had been captured in Manchuria and had amnesia for a period of captivity. So the basic theme was already there, known to the CIA before the book.
Now, tell us more about how it works. What happens in the mind? I would guess too that it would be some people would be more susceptible. I mean, I know that there's so many different things that they've tried, and we can certainly go into the intricacies of those as well. But maybe you can just tell us a bit more about that. How does it work, and how efficient is it to create a kind of a, I guess, a slave, for the lack of a better term, that just does whatever you want them to do?
Well, this is well described in all these documents. So, going back to the Second World War with the OSS, I have the main figure there is this man called G.H. Estabrooks, who was actually born in Canada, but his career was at Colgate College in New York State. And he contracted with the War Department, and I have a copy of that contract during the Second World War. He published from 1943 up till 1971. Repeatedly, very detailed descriptions of creating the super spy, which was basically a Manchurian candidate, where he would create a new identity, create an access code, and the mission could be carried out by the newly created identity, and the outfront person wouldn't remember anything. So, this is described by Estabrooks as being operational and actually used during the Second World War. So he could just be delusional himself or just talking big, but I've got a whole bunch of supporting documentation, including correspondence to the CIA in the Bluebird Artichoke era, where he's basically pitching his ability to create Manchurian candidates for them. I've got documentation back, correspondence back and forth between him and J. Edgar Hoover spanning several decades. Him basically selling the super spy idea to J. Edgar Hoover. He going to speak at conferences on military bases attended by military physicians and officers. Other MKUltra Bluebird Artichoke consultants all cleared at top secret, corresponding with him, coming to visit him, attending the same conferences, and publishing with him. So it's a very well-documented network of contractors. So this seems to be for real. It's not fiction. It's been used operationally. And the main purpose of it seems to be, as far as I can figure out, not that the person's going to do anything they wouldn't ordinarily do, because you can train anybody to go and shoot the enemy or blow up a bridge or whatever you need them to do. It seems to me that the logic is when the person's captured, they're immune to interrogation because the interrogator can't get through to the personality in the background. And the CIA documents describe counterintelligence efforts to spot these conditioned, programmed, mind-controlled agents being run by other intelligence agencies against the United States.
Right.
It seems like it's a for real used thing that actually works. And the whole idea of you can make somebody do something through mind control, that's just kind of like a diversion red herring.
Oh, really? You think so?
Yeah, because what do you need to do some fancy mind control for to make somebody shoot the enemy?
Well, the only reason I can think of is to use someone who is basically unaware to seemingly don't have any ties to this, right? So you would create a perfect patsy, for example. You had someone who performs an assassination, and then basically, as we've seen with Sirhan Sirhan and some of these other people that are, well, I guess they're quite open at this stage that they've been manipulated in some way if we listen to their testimony. But some of them seems to be largely kind of unaware what has happened or even what they've done, or that they're kind of disconnected from the operation that they have been a part of, if you know what I mean.
Right, and that seems to me to be the whole purpose of it, is the amnesia, which provides the cover and provides the resistance to interrogation. As far as how it's done, it's not any one thing, and it's really not very surprising or hard to understand. It's a combination of all these different techniques. So you don't just walk up to somebody and say, "Hi, would you like to be a suicide bomber this weekend?" There's got to be some sort of process of conditioning, training, persuading. And so in the I kind of divide it into two levels. I call one level general brainwashing and one I call psychiatric mind control. So you can mind control, brainwash somebody through general propaganda, just the way the culture operates, religious indoctrination, getting them into a cult, whatever. But I'm interested specifically in when there's a psychiatrist or psychologist involved on a one-to-one basis as part of a program run by a government. And I'm mainly interested in that because I think it's just totally outrageous ethically. But in terms of how it works, it's just these things I was listening. You get control of the person, you have control over the life space, what information they get, control over whether they live or die ultimately. You do sensory deprivation, sensory isolation, good cop, bad cop techniques, mock executions, terrorize them, frighten them, make them think they're going to die at any second. And then you add on medications by mouth, by IV, hypnosis, and that's basically the package.
And I can just imagine how many different combinations of this they must have tried on people to find the, I guess, the methods that worked. But again, it might be different methods that work on different people. But tell us specifically about the multiple personality, compartment of this or area of how that could be a potentiality of, for example, using a a double agent or maybe even a triple agent that you can compartmentalize information. And ultimately, I guess some of these agents could be carriers of information, information that the subconscious might know, but not the conscious mind. So if they were caught, there might not even through torture be a way that the enemy, if you will, could extract that information.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what this guy, G.H. Esterbrooks, describes. So he says he always, there's a lot of detail missing. So he describes them as susceptible individuals, but he doesn't really say what it is that makes them susceptible, except the fact that they're in the army and they've got orders and so on. But probably what makes them susceptible is they're highly hypnotizable, which depending on the cutoff is like 5 or 10% of the population. You can easily go into trance states, have post-hypnotic amnesia, block out physical pain, and so on. So it's somebody who's already good at that. And not in the documents, but when people tell me, probably they select people who've already been traumatized, abused, and already have multiple personality in place as a defense mechanism against all of the trauma. And then they take that person who already has the building blocks in place and they build on that. But that's not described in any documents. But I imagine that actually, in fact, is true and has happened. And so G.H. Esterbrooks describes a Marine who's got personality A, Jones A and Jones B. So Jones A is the regular guy who doesn't know anything, is out of the ordinary. Jones B is the conditioned personality. And Jones B is called into a general's office in the United States, or a colonel or whatever level of command. And the colonel has a little chat with him and then says, the moon is clear, which is a post-hypnotic signal that's been implanted by Esterbrooks. This causes him to switch to Jones B. Jones B is then given some classified information. Jones A is called back out. Jones A is given some cover documents to take over to Japan. He flies over to Japan. He walks into the commanding officer's office in Japan, hands him the documents that are of no importance whatsoever. The commander on the other end says, the moon is clear. Out comes the alter personality, gives him the declassified, the classified message. The response is inserted and back he goes to the other end. And then he describes also these guys being used for infiltration and penetration operations, as in penetrating some foreign cell or group that you're targeting. He doesn't talk about assassinations, but it could be any mission of any kind. In the CIA documents, there's experiments using secretaries of the CIA personnel who are highly hypnotizable. And the experiments include, they're basically sort of practice run sessions, getting somebody to go into a room, retrieve a document, and then have no memory of it. Getting a woman who's 19 years old to fire a gun at somebody that she thinks is a traitor, and she believes that the gun is loaded. And then she has no memory of doing that afterwards. And then the most complex one is a woman who's been hypnotically conditioned and programmed, and she's instructed to pass a small suitcase to another woman, and the other woman, and there's some code signals involved in that, and the other woman then uses the package to assemble a bomb, which she thinks is real, to blow up a target. So there's two controlled women interacting with each other. This is what's documented. So I always say what's documented is obviously just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. Well, there are people that have spoken out about this in different ways. You've worked with some of these people as well, and it seems to be a very difficult, murky area, because we have, of course, not only the problem of memory itself, how accurately do these people remember things, but it's also about things that might have been inserted within them, and then the question is, how accurately can you extract the information out of what has happened, etc. What are some of the things that you've encountered when it comes to working with people like this?
Well, I divide doing treatment from investigating it and sort of the public ethics and et cetera and the politics of it. So when I'm focused on treatment, whether it's just quotes regular incest, or it's some kind of satanic cult, or it's CIA military mind control, or Masonic mind control, or whatever it might be, I'd basically adopt a position of therapeutic neutrality, which means, unless there's objective evidence one way or the other, which 99% of the time there isn't, therapeutic neutrality means I don't believe, and I also don't not believe. I'm neutral. And the whole purpose of the therapy is stabilization and eventually recovery, so that you're not having all these mental health system symptoms, you're not suicidal, you're not coming to the hospital, and you can live a regular life. That's the goal. And the way to get there doesn't involve proving or disproving the childhood memories. And it doesn't involve investigating them, because you don't have the time or the money or the ability to investigate things that happened 20 or 30 years ago anyway. And so, in terms of doing treatment, I listen, and I've heard many, many, many stories from many people about very complicated mind control and so that ballpark of things. And I also get emails and contacts from people who tell stories that range from obviously highly disturbed, delusional, mixed up people whose thought processes are all jumbled up and nothing makes sense, and you could never find any reality in there, no matter how hard you tried. At the other end, I get have contact with people who are perfectly sensible, rational, make sense, they're functional, they tell a story that's plausible. They explain how they got drawn into this, whether it was parents or a boyfriend or who it was. They identify the places where it was done, and everything seems just as believable as any story anybody would tell, except for the fantastic nature of it. But when I'm doing therapy, I don't worry about it one way or the other. And I've got a lot of detailed writing and treatment plans and so on that I've published, which the basic strategy is, you're going to do the same intervention, have the same strategy, have the same goals, and the recovery tasks are the same, whether you assume the memories are real or not real. So there's this big difference between how I proceed when I'm working as a therapist and how I proceed as an investigator.
Yeah, there's two different ways there. Now, obviously, there are some people that have, well, I guess more or less turned against you or your practices that, what do you think that is? Is that part of the built-in defense? Because there are organizations here, obviously, that have been set up to, well, I believe, counter some of the information that started to come out. They claim false memories and that this has been inserted, etc. And this is, of course, very difficult for us who's on the outside to figure out what's true here, what's going on. It's a really murky area, if you ask me, anyway.
Oh yeah, it's as murky as it gets. So, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation was formed in April 1992, and it was created. The sort of public rationale was: there's all these out of control therapists with all these suggestible female clients who are generating all these false memories, and then they're publicly accusing, usually their fathers, of incest. And this is horrible because the fathers are innocent. And we have to do something about this, and we're a support organization for these fathers. That was kind of the starting point. And then they formed a advisory board with various professionals. But then very quickly, these subgroup of the professional advisory people were testifying in many, 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 many malpractice lawsuits, where they always said the same thing, which is, it's all false memories, is implanted by the therapist, multiple personalities, not really a real thing. And it's an outrage, and the person should be, their insurance company should be paying millions of dollars. So it became a big industry. And like anything, there's all different points of view and different motives going on. So as far as I could figure out, within the false memory group, there were several subgroups of people with different motives. So one group of people was kind of biological psychiatrists who didn't want trauma to re be relevant, period. So therefore, they didn't want any of this complicated trauma to be causing serious mental health problems. So they just had to discredit the whole thing. Then there was a group of memory researchers, academic memory researchers, who weren't happy with the idea that memory could operate like this, because it just didn't fit their theories. So they wanted to discredit the memory theory part of it. Then there's a group of people who just made a lot of money as expert witnesses. Then there was a group of people who were anti-Freudian, and they mistakenly thought that this was all a bunch of Freudian therapy, so they attacked it because they didn't like Freud. And then there's a group of people who I have no doubt, and I talked to some of them directly, who I have no doubt were actually, in fact, probably falsely accused. So then there's a subgroup of people who are generally falsely accused. They need the support, and there's these professionals who want to provide that support. And then there's a subgroup of people who are just, which I don't know which person was which, but they were just basically pedophile, sex offender, rapist, child molester people looking for a cover story. So there's all these different groups. And then in there on the professional advisory board is two guys who died in the late 90s, Martin Orne and Jolly West, were both psychiatrists who were cleared at top secret as contractors on MKUltra in the areas of dissociation, hypnosis, which is the core of the Manchurian candidate programs. So I can't prove, but I basically believe firmly that those two guys and maybe a couple other ones were mainly motivated by, uh-oh, some of these program people are kind of blowing a fuse and coming into civilian therapies and telling their stories, and we need a cover story to discredit that.
Right.
And then part of the strategy was then attacking people like me and with articles and on cable channel documentaries and in the courts as strongly as possible to try and just shut it all down.
Yeah, because you'd think that they would have to try to deal with it in some way if this information is starting to get out. Specifically, then if it has been successful and if there's things that they continue to use. I'm always intrigued by the fact that they released some of the documents to begin with. I guess they had to by law, or maybe they even expected that no one would go look for it and find out or something like that. I don't know.
It's hard to figure out. So the story is that in 73, Richard Helms, the director of the CIA, ordered Sidney Gottlieb, who was the head of MKUltra, to destroy all of the MKUltra documents. But somehow, seven boxes of documents got missed and were a few years later found in an archive somewhere. Well, so that's just typical bumbling bureaucracy and human error, and that's possible. That seems a little doubtful to me.
Right. What do you think happened then? Why?
Well, there's a strategy that's in the literature. If you read background literature on CIA and so on, the strategy is called a limited hangout. It's a standard strategy. You release a little bit of the truth to cover up the greater part of the truth.
Right.
And so that's, I think, the main thing that's going on there. They had to, confess to something or other to satisfy the Senate committees and the politicians and so on. And then some of it just kind of got out by mistake. So if you go through all the MKUltra documents, everybody's name is whited out all over the place. So there's lots and lots of redaction. But Sidney Gottlieb, who is the director of the CIA, his name is not whited out multiple times in the documents. So is that just a coincidence? I doubt it. So I think he was in some way betrayed and hung out to dry. I talked to him on the phone prior to his death once, and he started off the conversation with, well, I identified myself and said I'm a psychiatrist and this is why I'm calling. And he started off just vague on everything. He couldn't remember anybody named Martin Orne. He couldn't remember anybody named Jolly West. And I said, well, yeah, he was a contractor on MKUltra subproject this, such and such in this year. And all of a sudden he could remember him. And so it was a very cat and mouse game kind of conversation. But at one point he told me, there was a second unit. In other words, a whole nother MKUltra program that's never been declassified that nobody knows about, run by some other group within the CIA in parallel to his. So that was interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. And well, is that all you have on that at this moment? Has anybody else come forward, or any other documentation on this?
Not hard documentation, no. I've all kinds of people have come forward with stories.
Can we believe them all, do you think?
You can't believe them all, and you can't disbelieve them all. One person I've worked with, whose name is Karen Wetmore, has published a book. Actually, she'd be a good guest for you in the future.
Mm.
And I'm the publisher of the book. I never have treated her. She's never been a patient of mine. But she contacted me in the late 90s, and we've maintained contact ever since. And the book is called Surviving Evil, and it's about her personal story growing up in Vermont, which is a northern state in the United States. It's a very rural, beautiful part of the world. And she was admitted to a hospital. She had some prior trauma, and she was admitted to the hospital in age 13. And within the next few years, she spent an awful lot of time in the hospital, and she had quite a lot of amnesia for it. And then she started investigating her story and requested her medical records, and there was a lot of bureaucratic resistance, and she had to get lawyers to get her records back. And lo and behold, in her medical record, which I have a copy of, is the name of one of the MKUltra contractors, Robert Hyde, who is a psychiatrist, Harvard linked, who did four or five different MKUltra projects on LSD with a top secret clearance. That was the beginning. And then she filed all kinds of Freedom of Information Act requests, got all kinds of documents from the hospital, from the literature, and built up this whole network of different doctors, four or five or six of whom were at Vermont State Hospital at the same time as her and involved in her treatment, who were publishing with documented mind control contractors, working at the same facilities, going to the same conferences, and so on. And links up to McGill with Ewan Cameron, who was an MKUltra contractor. And so all these cross links. John Gittinger, who was the head psychologist for MKUltra, she's got him directly tied into her medical record and people in her medical record who are co-authors of Gittinger. So she did a fabulous job, unlike any I've ever seen before, of documenting her personal story, which is why I elected to publish the book. And very rare. Most people just, it's basically impossible to document. So people will contact me saying that they're being controlled by some sort of electromagnetic weapons that are being beamed at them by either they don't know who or quotes the government, or sometimes they identify specific people. And that's causing all the following symptoms, and the voices are being inserted into their head electronically and so on. It's totally impossible ever to prove. And it's completely easy to discredit because the person just sounds like a tinfoil hat, nutcase.
Very difficult. There's got to be ways. I've, you know, we've done programs on this, so we've heard from people, and you know, they come forth with their story. And the most problematic thing I think is that, you know, it's impossible to know their state of mind, because I've said to someone, well, you got to start documenting things. You know, what happens? Write up. You know, what do you know? You got to observe your own behavior, start seeing what, you know, what changes, what doesn't. But it's almost like they need an outside observer to be able to do those things, if it's true that they are being, you know, manipulated on a cognition kind of level, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so then I don't really have anything to offer these people because I don't have a private practice that I would take them into anyway. But I can't validate that it's real because I can't prove it. I can't tell them it's not real, which they won't listen to anyway. I can't send them to some surgeon who can take an implant out of their brain because I don't know any such surgeon. I can't send them to some security expert who's going to manufacture a helmet for them that's going to block whatever it is. So there's just kind of nothing I can do other than suggest that you get some sort of good trauma therapist with good boundaries to work with, to provide you whatever support is possible. And then generally they think that's just blowing them off, and I don't think it's real.
Right. Well, there are plausible, you know, issues going on here with pertaining to experiments and things that we know from the documentation. And of course, they would, you know, we know they're kind of they just do what they want. They might pick up people and experiment on them. We can talk. I mean, there's different categories here, as you mentioned before. There is you know, cults. You mentioned Freemasonry. There's also, you know, what people call satanic ritual abuse. And we can talk more about some of this later in more detail and see if they differ, or maybe these are some of the other cover programs that are in some way tied into the military, for example. But if we speak more about the military techniques specifically, maybe you can just tell us how they create what they call multiple personality and what methods they use to traumatize people.
Well, in the documents, it's all the things I listed, the sensory deprivation, isolation, etc. And outside the documents and stories that people have told me, it's basically ramped up, which, again, either seems fantastic, or if you go, well, wait a minute, it's not quite so fantastic. Because what do we know from the photos at Abu Ghraib? And this was, the effort was to say there's just a couple of rogue people who got out of control, which is totally ridiculous. Seymour Hersh, who's a very well-known for many decades reporter on intelligence matters, wrote an article in which he named the programs that were the interrogation mind control programs at Abu Ghraib. So there's actual cryptonym that's known in public. And this is clearly a whole set of techniques that come out of interrogation manuals that have been declassified and go back to MKUltra and also are being used at Abu Ghraib, at Guantanamo Bay. So in the photos from Abu Ghraib, first of all, we know the people are prisoners. We know that their life space is totally controlled. We know that there's food deprivation, sleep deprivation. They're using electric shock, hooding, having to sit in very painful positions for many hours, being humiliated sexually, having their religion denigrated and slandered in front of them, being forced to masturbate in front of U.S. female officers, being forced to engage in sort of sexual-like behaviors with each other, get together in sort of piles on top of each other all naked, threatened attacks by guard dogs who are really scary and right in their faces. So all these techniques we know for a fact are being used currently.
Right.
And you take those, and that includes sexual humiliation. So it's just a little step from there to the stories I hear, which is the doctors who were military doctors, who are often described as Dr. Black, Dr. White, Dr. Green, most commonly Dr. Green. And then some of the people think that Dr. Green was actually Joseph Mengele, who was brought over covertly and was in the U.S. mind control programs, which is another thing I can comment in a bit. And they describe all these techniques with addition of wearing weird goggles, being spun around physically, memorization tasks, group tasks that they do with other children, and then being caged, terrorized, and sexually abused systematically, all as part of the terror program to split their minds and control their minds.
Before we move on here, Colin, since you're down in Texas and we're speaking here, it's the day after the shooting that occurred at the, it was a Muhammad cartoon exhibit. It was put on by Pamela Geller and some of these other people there. Even Geert Wilders from Holland was there and whatnot. But a lot of people have been watching these events that happened in Paris and Copenhagen and, you know, many other places before that. And as always, I think within the alternative, we should be very suspicious of how this is spun in the media, how it's being used. I never discount the aspect that this might be a real event, considering that there have been tensions like this, you know, in the past, and it's on a kind of a religious basis, which is, of course, very, very emotional for people. However, I think the calling card is when it's being spun, the way it is in the media and how it's being sought to be used. But anyway, what is the possibility here that we're talking about an individual that has ties to the intelligence services? I think it was known that the gentleman who's been accused at this stage had contact with FBI. He was, I don't know if it was an informant flat out, but there was some kind of tie in here. But is these the kinds of events then that they would be able to use, let's say, as a pretext to build up more resentment between, I guess, Americans and ultimately Europe as well, and the Arab world? Or how do you view an event like this?
Well, let's say that those guys have been captured, not killed, and there's a trial on, and I get called as a defense expert witness or prosecution, either way. But I'm called in to talk to these guys and try and figure out, okay, what happened here psychologically? We know what happened logistically and guns and bullets wise in the car and so on. So my opening things that I would want to try and figure out would be whether it's one or two guys. Is it basically a lone person just acting on their own, no contact with anybody else? And are they acting, if so, are they acting basically for political motives or just kind of anger acting out? Or is it some sort of heavy, serious mental illness with delusional thinking and so on? That's option number one. Option number two then is they're not acting alone. They're in some way influenced, controlled, or handled by some group. And then I would want to know, well, who is the group? Is it like a Aryan Brotherhood white supremacy type group? Is it a Muslim, terrorist group? Is it this? Who is it?
Right.
Sort of Black Panther style. And then within that, and then we're inching towards, is it a government? And then I want to know, have any of these psychiatric mind control techniques and methods been used? Is this a Manchurian candidate? Now, trying to figure that out is going to be complicated and tricky, but that's the options I would be looking at. Whether it's a mass shooter, such as the one in Norway, the mass shooters in the United States, whether they're adolescents or adults, whether it's a terrorism-like operation, or whether it's a riot and protest type operation.
Right. And that's very difficult to figure out too, because there's a lot of people obviously that they throw around, well, they're mind control and they kind of leave it at that. But obviously it's a very detailed, involved procedure to be able to get to these conclusions. I think we can have a lot of suspicions and rightfully so. We should, considering everything we know then and what's going on. But a lot of people jump to conclusions as well before they, have all the evidence there. But there are other shootings, that kind of seem to mimic this too. You had the shooting in, was it in Aurora, the movie theater, and very strange behavior in the courts by James Holmes, for example, that was accused for this, right?
Yeah, very strange. He's clearly a highly disturbed individual, but again, that would be the same thing if I was interviewing him. Is this just a mental illness case, or what's going on here? With Tamerlan Sarnoff, the now deceased Boston Marathon bomber, there was a very long report published in the Boston Globe, which is a very mainstream, stable, sober kind of entity, which had a lot of detail. And it's very clear that multiple family members described him, and there's actual quotes in the article, describe him as saying he hears voices in his head telling him to do things, and he feels like there's another person living inside him. I mean, so that's not just something you would want to ignore or discount. Obviously, if he was alive and I was the expert witness and I was interviewing him, I'd want to know a whole lot about that. When did these voices start? Who do you think this other person is? Did you feel like you were in control of this behavior, that behavior, this behavior, that behavior? And then his whole trip over to the Chechnya area is cloaked in great mystery, how he got over there, how that was financed, who he contacted over there. And the whole question of why the KGB, or the current form of the KGB, contacted the FBI about this guy several years before the bombing. Why did that happen? And who really contacted who, and for what reasons, and how much of that is fact, and how much is a cover story? This applies to all these cases. Let me tell you a strange story that anybody can easily Google. So in May 5th, 1979, Jimmy Carter was running for re-election. He lost to Reagan, but he was giving a speech in Southern California. And all of a sudden in the crowd, there was this disturbance, and the Secret Service wrestled these two guys to the ground who had starter pistols. And Jimmy Carter was about to unveil some huge, economic reform plan that would be of interest to the Hispanic population, which would shake up, the powers that be in the business world. So these two guys are wrestled to the ground, and all of this is in the mainstream media and reported, you know, in Associated Press and so on. And the Secret Service initially thinks that these guys are just drunk and telling some story. And their story is, well, they didn't know each other prior to arriving in, I think it was in San Diego, but it was Southern California. And another guy who they'd never met before basically kind of hired the two of them, and the night before had them up on the roof of a hotel practicing with their starter pistols and assigned them the task of providing a diversion with the starter pistols so that he could kill Carter with his rifle, because he was a highly trained some assassin sniper guy. So this the Secret Service thought this is just nonsense. But these two guys told them the specific hotel room. And so the Secret Service went to the hotel room, and lo and behold, this covert, highly trained assassin had left behind some bullets and a gun case. And then these two guys, and this is all reported in the mainstream media, and then these two guys are never charged with a crime, never prosecuted, and just disappear from sight, never to be spoken about again. And Jimmy Carter flies back to Air Force Andrews Base and is quoted by a reporter who was there as saying, "I've lost control of the government." So that's an interesting story. But what are these two guys' names? Raymond Lee Harvey and Osvaldo Ortiz.
Right. There you go.
So this is just, I mean, it's so preposterous. And the mainstream media, like the ABC, NBC News, just go, huh, funny coincidence. So clearly, this is an operation. And this is a message to Carter. Hey, Raymond Lee Harvey and Osvaldo Ortiz are going to be coming after you. And Raymond Shaw is the mind-controlled shooter assassin in the Manchurian Candidate. So Raymond Lee Harvey was not a random choice of the first name there.
And these leak out in the media. It might not be true, of course. It might just be, but still it slips out to the media. Maybe, well, even some people have speculated there that there's another layer to the intrigue there, but who knows, right?
But it's clearly not just a random coincidence that Raymond Lee Harvey Oswald and Osvaldo Ortiz were two real guys. That was their real names. And they just bumped into each other by random coincidence, and then they bumped into this other guy.
Yeah,
it can't be a random coincidence. It's impossible.
Now, let me just ask you here. We'll take a break in a little bit here. We'll talk about some of your websites and some of the titles and whatnot that you have available. But just on a psychological level, let's say, someone like Tsarnaev or some of these other people that have been involved in these kinds of things. Is it possible psychologically that if we suppress really strong emotions of anger and we perhaps have internal struggle on a more level that we, you know, we feel maybe anger to do something, but we, you know, we know that it's not right, you can't do that, you hold it down, whatever, that this in some way would create disassociation or another type of personality that might actually, you know, I guess for the lack of a better term, you break or you snap and you just act out these emotions that you have that you've been suppressing for a long time. Is that a possibility, do you think?
Yeah, that happens all the time with people that I work with clinically. They have multiple personalities because of all kinds of childhood abuse and trauma as they're growing up. And then the stress level builds up and they just do some. Usually the behavior is directed at themselves, but they just do some violent, destructive behavior, and then they end up in the hospital and we work with them. So that's common.
Yeah, exactly. One last thing here. Is it possible they also use people who have history of schizophrenia, for example, and already kind of certain modalities in place for this to work better?
Well, there's confusion in the professional literature and in the culture about what is the difference between schizophrenia and multiple personality. And multiple personality is officially called dissociative identity disorder now. And a lot of people in the schizophrenia field talk as if they're totally separate things and it's very easy to tell the difference. But I think it's another murky thing. It's kind of confusing. Sometimes it's very clear, but oftentimes, really, what is the difference and what are the symptoms and how do you tell? And if you go back to the original book on schizophrenia by Eugen Bleuler, who was in a hospital in Switzerland, and he coined the word schizophrenia which is the title of the book, Dementia Precox, or the Group of Schizophrenias. So it was called Dementia Precox up till 1911, and then the name switched to schizophrenia. And many of these classical cases of schizophrenia that he describes are completely detailed, clear cases of multiple personality. But he's calling them schizophrenia. So, but if somebody who has schizophrenia, who's got extremely disorganized thinking processes, and you can't even really follow from one paragraph to the next, and obviously, like, their delusions are things like, I always use the example of, the Martians are controlling me through a gyroscope that my mother's gynecologist implanted in my brain at birth. So people right. with multiple personality don't have those kind of, quotes, crazy delusions, and which nobody's going to consider, well, maybe one person in a billion might consider could be real. So if you have somebody like that with schizophrenia, what use would they be to you as an agent? Like, they can't function. They're so disorganized. They would never be able to follow instructions.
Right. Yep. It's a good point. Well, Colin, tell us where people who would like to find out more about your work can go, and tell us about some of the titles. I think you have a couple of yourself out there, and then you have a few others that you've published as well. Give us the details.
Well, you can just search under Colin A. Ross, MD, or the Ross Institute, and it's www.rossinst.com, which is short for Institute. And there's a button on the website for bookstore, and I have a publishing company that I own that publishes mostly my books. And they're also all available on Amazon.com. So it's the two quickest place to get ways to get to me and my books.
Okay, we'll have the links up on our website, of course, folks, so you can click through from ours easily. And we'll continue here and pick up in the second, and continue to talk much more about the things we haven't gotten into yet. So stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Colin. We'll be right back.
I couldn't change my mind. Please use your mind.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the second hour, we proceed with Dr. Colin Ross to speak more about his work and also his work with patients who claim to have been subjected to the kind of programs that we've been talking about. We get into the murky territory of so-called satanic ritual abuse. Well, interestingly, I know that this was used by the, for example, Swedish man-hating organization ROKS, who spread lies about a satanic network operating within Swedish politics and business by males strictly, who did this towards women as a way of controlling them. This was exposed later as being a fraud, lies, in a documentary called The Gender War that you can search for on YouTube and look at if you're interested. It's subtitled as well. And this is a perfect example of how something like this can be misused. Perhaps this also helps to divert away from any real potential, you know, Jimmy Savile's out there and this kind of activity that actually is going on, like in Britain. And this is not just in the British elite, but also in cities like Rotherham and Halifax by Pakistani gangs, for example. So this takes many different shapes and forms, and these might not particularly be satanic in origins, but it is within the same area. So this is a very difficult subject to go into, but we'll speak some about it in the second hour, and we'll try to get Colin's take on what might be real and what might not be real. We also go into how drugs, in particular LSD and other synthetics, was used in the 60s as a live experiment with the counterculture that started up on the university campuses. This is the inception of cultural Marxism with the aid of the CIA and the music industry and everything else. We also talk about the Frank Olson case, honeypots, false memory syndrome, and much, much more. So don't miss it. Tune into this and any of our previous programs at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up, and we have all the details for you right there. We have upcoming Tom Rousel, a very fascinating show on Anglo-Saxon pagan culture. We have Christopher Hell, Greg Johnson, Jonas Degir, Sophia Smallstorm, Veronica Clark, Stephen McNallan, and many more after this. But we'll take a short break right here, and then we'll be right back with more. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.